Friends, did you know that the temperature at night can have one of the biggest impacts on your sleep quality? If you often wake up too hot or too cold, I can definitely recommend Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics and makes temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. In addition to their self-cooling properties for better quality sleep, Miracle Made bedding has awesome self-cleaning properties so you can say goodbye to stale odors. And you'll get the luxurious, super comfortable feel we're all looking for without the ridiculously high price tag. I have to be honest with you guys, I truly love my white Miracle Made sheets. They are so clean, they are so crisp, and they prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. This leaves them to stay cleaner and fresher 3 times as long than other sheets. Most other sheets, they're teeming with little allergy and acne-causing bacteria that you do not want in your bed. So, why don't you just listen to me and go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code thestacks at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it is backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you are not 100% satisfied, you get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks and use the code thestacks to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode and making my bedtime even better. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today is The Stacks Book Club Day. We are joined again by the wonderful author of the book Flawless, Elise Hugh, to discuss the New York Times bestselling and National Book Award-winning novel, Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu. It's a satirical novel written in the style of a screenplay that follows Willis Wu. He hasn't yet taken the main stage in his own life when he is thrown into unexpected action and adventure. It's a book that deals with racial stereotyping, the performances we all do, and what it really means to assimilate. Elise and I talk about all of that and more on today's episode, and yes, there are spoilers. Listen through to the end of today's episode to find out what our April book club pick will be. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on each episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. If you like what you hear on today's podcast, consider joining The Stacks Pack, which is our community for book lovers. You can find it at patreon.com/thestacks. By joining, you make it possible for me to make this independent book podcast every single week, and you get a slew of perks for yourself. Things like access to our Discord community, bonus episodes, shout outs on the show, and of course, our monthly virtual book club, where we talk about The Stacks book club picks in detail as a group and have a really good time. So if that sounds like something you want to be a part of, go to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. Shout out to our newest members, Autumn Harrell, Brittany Porter, Rachel, Laura, Nadia, Anissa Din, Mariah Curl, and Ree. Thank you all so much, and thank you to the entire Stacks Pack. All right, now it is time for my conversation with Elise Hugh about Interior Chinatown. All right, everybody, I am back. It is the Stacks Book Club Day. I am joined again by the wonderful journalist, author, and my newest friend, I would say, Elise Hugh. Elise, welcome back to the Stacks.
I am so excited to be back because I loved this book.
And this book that we're talking about is Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu. It came out in 2020. It won the National Book Award. It was a national bestseller. And I'll give you guys a quick rundown about it. We will spoil the book. So if you haven't read it yet, you should stop and read it and come back. We'll be here. But the premise is Willis Wu is a background actor on a show called Black and White, a cop procedural. And he wants to be a kung fu guy. I should say this book is a satire. It's written like a screenplay, and it's a commentary about Asian people in media and America and assimilation and sort of the performances that people, Asian people specifically, but I think all of us sort of fall into in the pursuit of the American ideal or Americanness,
which is coded as whiteness, or American dominant culture, which tends to be coded as whiteness, right?
Right. Yes. Americanness as in like the preconceived notion of America, which is white, and not necessarily Americanness, which is actually all of us.
Right.
Okay. Let's start where we always start. Generally, what did you think about the book, Elise?
I thought it was such a delight to read. It's pretty fast paced because it is written as a screenplay. So what a cool format. I loved the way he played with form here. Willis Wu is a character, as you described, in this procedural. So during the screenplay parts of this book, where you see the dialogue and you see the shots described, like interior and exterior and moving shots, where if you've seen a screenplay form, obviously, and I'm assuming most of the listeners have, each shot has to be described because a film is a visual medium. And so that part moved very quickly. But in writing it as a screenplay, the author, Charles Yu, actually got to step out of the story sometimes, step out of the cop procedural black and white, and narrate what was going on in Willis Wu's head and his commentary about Asian American history in America and what it means to feel kind of invisible in the U.S. So I overall just really loved it. It's a blazingly fast read. I don't know how much time it took you. I know you tend to have to power through a lot of books. So how long did it take you to get through
this? I think
one?
I read it in 2 days. Yeah. I don't know. It was a pretty fast read, maybe three. I generally liked the book. I overall had a really fun time. I think like the questions he's asking about assimilation and all of that stuff, I'm really interested in. I was also really, you know, I'm Black. And so I was coming to this book with sort of, you know, I think like generally, and we can get into this more, the conversation around assimilation for Black people is really different in America because many of us were brought here and our ancestors were brought here. And so it's not the same thing of like, I gave up my life to come to this country, which is like sort of the immigrant narrative, right? And so I'm always interested in thinking about like, how Black people are positioned in these kinds of conversations. And I think that that's like a really interesting part of this book for me personally. I know that's like a very me-centric read, but that was something I was thinking about a lot with the character of Turner, but also with the ways that like Willis Wu was thinking about and talking about like the Black character. Mm-hmm. So that was really interesting to me. And then I also was just thinking about like a lot about the rules of the world. Because it's sort of like speculative fiction-y, right? Like it's not exactly just straight up Willis is an actor and he goes home and he's like not on set anymore because the whole thing is written like a screenplay, not just the scenes. Like, so I was really interested in that. I found it to be really interesting formally and like I was excited by it generally. I have some nitpicks later on.
Okay.
But like generally a solid A of a book, I would say, like overall really good.
And my main take on this and why I feel like I enjoyed it so much is because it is a book about race and identity. And we have gotten really serious or tend to be self-serious when we talk about race and identity in America and sexuality and gender. And I understand why we take it seriously. Obviously, there can be occasionally fatal consequences when it comes to the intersection of these various issues. I understand the impulse to be really serious, but this book shows us there are other ways to build empathy. There are other ways to talk about these kinds of issues and get people interested. And laughter and absurdity is one of those ways. And I thought the author did that very well.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should start there because this is a satire. And I was thinking a lot, again, about like the formal elements of this book, because I think you can't really read it and not think about it because it's so in your face, just like the Courier font, like everything you're seeing.
The spacing.
He's telling you, I want you to think about the form of this book. Like that is his instruction to us. And I was thinking a lot about satire. And I feel like one of the things about satire that's different than like general comedy is that satire, I feel the author and the reader are having a conversation and the reader has to be somewhat in the know. The reader has to be in community in some way with the author.
Yes.
If there's not a wink, wink, ha ha, irony situation going on, it's not satire and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so I think like part of to what you're saying is like, not only is Charles Yu using humor to do a lot of the work for him, but he's also using like,
ha ha ha. See what I'm getting at? The show's called Black and White, and it's about America. You see, there's no Asian in there. Like, ha ha, I'm not in this story. Like, and I think that that was so, so successful in this book. Like, I think this is an extremely successful satire.
What I liked was his constant referral of honor. Like, his characters all they all had to like perform a kung fu feat or show filial piety or save face or all these ideas that have become really Asian tropes. One of them in particular, of course, was like, I did it for the honor of my family or something about honor. And it was so funny. If you already know that these stereotypes exist and those are tropes rather than necessarily reality.
Right. And he even does it on like a really fine level with the language, especially early in the book. He talks like a lot about like so-and-so has lost the plot or like this, like he like is referring to film, like, I guess,
what jargon,
like, for turns of phrase. Yeah. Like lost the plot or like this thing about this character. And like she was really off the page, like she hopped off the page. Yeah. And you're just like, this is so like so wink, wink, nod, nod. And it really, like, normally I hate it, but it was so aggressively in your face that it really worked for me. Because I think from the beginning, he's saying to you, like, come on, I've got opinions. Don't you want to hear them? And he's not trying to create this sort of, like, it's not subtle. And usually that doesn't work, but it works here.
Yes, I completely agree. Until we get to the end, I don't know if I'm supposed to jump to this.
Let's jump because the end was where I struggled.
Act six, Willis Wu is on trial. I think act six.
For what?
That's
exactly
what was so confusing to me. Because act six is called the case of the missing Asian or something like that, or the case of the disappeared Asian. And all throughout the plot of the book leading up to that point, the missing Asian was his older brother. But for whatever reason, by Act 6, his brother is his attorney.
He's back.
So his older brother is back to represent him, Willis, as the missing Asian. And I'm guessing this is a meta commentary about how Willis has disappeared his true self or something like that.
Yeah.
But I got a little confused. And I think maybe that was the point of the trial itself, just to say, hey.
Yeah. Well, okay. So this is how I piece it together, basically. This is what I did, or this is what I was thinking. Because at the end of Act 5, Willis leaves. Remember, he takes a car, he leaves set.
Right.
So I think literally they're saying that because he's on trial for kidnapping an Asian person. And that is, he kidnapped himself.
Okay,
so the question is, he is the missing Asian because he took the car off set.
I must have
and
missed
ran away.
That. Pivot.
Yeah, he's the missing Asian at this point, but the other missing Asian
was his brother,
which is brother. And now he's back. I mean, of course, he's a great lawyer because he's older brother and older brother is great at everything. And he is then on trial for kidnapping himself, but then also he's the victim of a kidnapping. And so if he's guilty, that means he kidnapped himself. And if he's not guilty, that means he did it.
Okay. I get it.
It was a little tricky for me. I still, at the end of that scene, I still wrote in my book, wait, what did he do?
Yes. Okay. Clearly, I'm still thinking that because I was like, this is where it lost me a little bit, at least the plot details of it. But it didn't really matter that much to my experience of the book because of what the book was overall trying to say.
And because we'd gotten so absurd at this point, like it had gotten so crazy that it was sort of like, okay, let's go with it. Okay, before we like get too far into the ending, I want to go back and talk a little bit about the plot of the book. Sure. So Willis Wu, we meet him. He's a background guy. We kind of learn that like if you like this is the part about like the speculative fictiony stuff, like the world of the rules that I didn't quite understand. Like there was clearly a script for the show, right? But like you could, as an actor, inject yourself into the script and then the other actors would just like keep going, right? Like that's how Willis sort of like gets his break to become like background Asian or like Asian guy two and Asian guy one was by like being like, hey, he went that way. And then them being like, what did you say? You went where?
Right,
and so
exactly.
Like, there was a script, but it was almost like reality TV, too, because sometimes Turner and
That's
Green,
right.
the two detectives, would also break from the script. Did you have any like thoughts or feelings about that?
I didn't get confused that much when they were jumping in and out of it, because I thought that he did a good job at the very outset establishing the rules of the hierarchy, that essentially he was generic man three, and then he wanted to be generic Asian man two, and then generic Asian man one, and then that the highest rung of the ladder was to be Kung Fu guy, which his father, who we should talk about a little bit too, his father had finally achieved. And so in the scenes of Black and White, once Black and White were taken into Black and White and this cop procedural, I got the sense that he was trying to find ways to elbow himself in order to come up the hierarchy. So that wasn't too confusing for me until the story gets farther along and we're still in the procedural. And then I'm like, wait, are we trying to solve a case still? And it's a case of the week, obviously, because Black and White is supposed to be modeled after any procedural like Law and Order or New Amsterdam or whatever the ones that I can't think of right now that are on CBS.
NYPD Blue.
Sure, exactly. So I didn't, that didn't lose me until we were farther along in the story.
Right. Okay. And then, so he's on the show, whatever. He kind of makes himself important. And we learn that if you are killed off on the show, which ends up happening to Willis, you have to take a 45-day break. Mm-hmm. You're like on furlough. You can't work for 45 days because they have to be able to forget you enough. The audience has to be able to forget you enough. And then you can come back and play like anybody, but you have to start at the bottom again.
Right.
And like
you can be a delivery boy or
Yeah. Which I also, I love that detail of like, well, you can be back in a little bit, because I'm a person who watches like Grey's Anatomy still. And
now
I always
in season 20,
about, I know the new season starts next week, I think, or this week, Thursday, maybe. Anyways, not important. Thursday as we're recording, as you're listening, it's already come back. As a person who watches a show like that, I do think about like, or like Law and Order, like all the working actors in New York City who have been on an episode of Law and Order and then die.
As
and
a dead body.
Oh, that's it. You're done. Like, see you never. Good luck. Hope you had that nice time. So then in the, this is all the plot of just Willis, because there's other stuff going on, but all of Willis. So Willis then eventually meets this woman who's like kind of like a high up, ethnically ambiguous friend of the detectives. She's like adjacent detective, but she's not Green or Turner. She's like other person who is something, but we don't know. And she's nice to him. And then they hit it off and then they start dating and then they fall in love and then they have a kid. And then they fight because she has like career opportunities to have her own show. But Willis really wants to become Kung Fu guy because he's working his way towards his one big goal, which is to be Kung Fu guy, which means he's made it as an Asian. Right. And I say Asian because it's very specifically not any kind of Asian. It's very generally Asian, right? Like we know a little bit about Willis's family, but as far as the show is concerned, it's just like Asian guy.
He's slotted into that.
Yes, it's generally Asian.
Right.
So Willis is like, fuck you, Karen, my wife. Fuck you, kid. I'm going to be Kung Fu guy. And becomes a deadbeat dad Kung Fu guy. And then he runs away. And then that takes us to the trial.
The confusing trial at the end. Because who was running? Or who had disappeared? Was it him? Was it his brother? But okay, so something that I wanted to point out was, just as you mentioned, how he's become deadbeat. There was an interesting parallel between how he abandoned his family in order to assimilate or not necessarily assimilate, but achieve this upper echelon of Kung Fu guy, because his father very much did the exact same thing. He was largely alienated from his father, or felt alienated from his father, because his father had, after immigrating to the United States from Taiwan, after seeing his own father get shot by Taiwanese militia, he came to the United States and was studying, like he was in grad school or something rather academic, but found that he couldn't get past his forever foreigner status and wound up just playing into the idea of Asian guy as Kung Fu guy, and really became a Kung Fu master, which is called Sifu in the story. Sifu meaning, which is how you address somebody who's teaching you anything really in Chinese. And so it was interesting, a parallel between the father and son and how they both kind of became alienated from their kids. And then also his wife, Karen, his eventual wife, Karen, it is revealed, I guess, after their romantic montage, which was a fun little interlude. I think that was my favorite part of the book, actually. It was revealed after their quick romantic montage that she was actually in the poster of the show as the third character. And then she reveals to him at during their courtship that she can speak some Taiwanese. And apparently she can speak Taiwanese better than Willis himself. And he was surprised that she had this identity. And she was sort of like, this is a commentary on how it's advantageous in many cases to appear ethnically ambiguous, because then you can get slotted into more roles as an actor. But also it shows how society tends to reward those that aren't too foreigner looking, quote unquote foreigner. I'm holding up my quote marks and have some sort of proximity to whiteness.
Well, right. And that like ethnically ambiguous thing is like, I feel like it's one of those things that we're always constantly told is in.
It's always right? It's always in to not look too much of your race.
Yeah, exactly. Because in the beginning, remember, he thinks that she's maybe like Latina.
Yes.
That's how he describes her originally. And I know, I think like the performance of blank, whether that's blackness for Turner or like white ladiness for Green and obviously like Asianness for most of the characters in this is just so interesting to me. And I'm so obsessed with the idea of performance generally, but specifically with this book, like the whole performance of older brother, like
that he had to be the high achiever, the striver, the one that could do no wrong.
Right. And that he's the one who disappears that we're all like looking for, like that the whole thing revolves around because he is the perfect Asian man, right? He's just tall enough, but not so tall to be like Yao Ming, right? Like that's part of it. And that he's handsome and he can slam dunk and he's good at school and he's a lawyer. And like, I find all of that, like, because I think as regular, I think what's interesting to me about performance is that as regular people, we play into it too.
Mm-hmm. All the world's a stage.
Yeah. And like that there is like, even this book existing and like Charles Yu being recognized for it. And like, even that is performance. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like it's a little meta, but I just think about like who gets to be the Asian who writes the book that wins the National Book Award, you know, like who gets to be the Asian who is on NPR and does TED Talks daily? Who gets to be the black girl who talks about books in a fun way? Like, and why us? You know, and like, I think that that is a really interesting, I don't know if interesting, but that's just something that I think about a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely worth unpacking because I remember there were lots of things that this book then sort of reminded me of in the deep recesses of my memory. Mm. You know, when I first moved to Washington, D.C. to work at NPR, I was in line for a Starbucks. So this is all, I'm bringing this up all in the context of all this anti-AAPI hate that has happened in the wake of coronavirus or after coronavirus emerged and has never gone away, but we've just gotten a lot more attention for this anti-Asian violence that's been happening. And I grew up in very white places, as you know. I grew up in suburban St. Louis and then suburban Dallas. And so I never really questioned my identity that much. I had run into various tinges of racism from other kids and things like that. But it wasn't until I was like 29 years old and living in Washington, D.C. and in line for a Starbucks that an old veteran, I assume, came up to me and said, "We won the war. Go home." And I was so taken aback by this sense that, well, first of all, he had confused me with the Japanese people, right?
Because, I was thinking the Vietnamese people.
Because we lost that war.
Well, we did, but I feel I was thinking that he was like trying to write the record.
Yeah. Well, it could have been either way.
It could have been Korean. Who knows? It could, you know, history
there
doesn't
matter.
So many
it could wars.
Have been anyone. Yeah. Yes.
But just this notion of like not belonging here. And I think that happens so often when marginalized communities are targeted by racism. And it got me thinking a lot. What got me thinking about this was the dad, was the father, and then the mother, because they had done everything supposedly right. They paid their taxes. They went to college. They were productive citizens, or they tried to be. And yet, when he was in college, when the dad was in college, he was just, and he expected to sort of, he was finally earning a salary, more than he had ever earned. And then
and yet, more than he would ever earn again.
Right. And more than he would ever earn again, because he ended up, him and his cohort of other Asian students ended up getting targeted by anti-Asian hate, essentially. Right. And this notion of like being able to try and do everything right and assimilate, play by the rules that you're supposed to play by, learn the etiquette, learn the norms, and be here in many cases longer than a lot of European immigrants. Something that they point out in this book is the history of exclusion of Asians and Chinese migration to America. And despite being in America, in many cases, longer than European immigrants, still being seen as people who don't belong, people who need to, who can be the targets of casual jokes. It continues. I mean, we just saw Shane, what's his name? Shane Gillis, host Saturday Night Live. Or get invited back to host Saturday Night Live, despite losing his job on the cast for all these anti-Asian and homophobic and anti-Semitic slurs. So there is a sense that the you don't belong here idea continues to ripple despite everything else you do to try and be a part of dominant culture.
Right. And also, like, I mean, in the father storyline, his friend Alan is beaten up and they... the father lives in a house with, like, it's like a multicultural Asian house. Right. It's like there's Indian guys. There's a Korean, there's a Taiwanese. Right. Like, it's like just a general Pan-Asian restaurant. You know, it's like a restaurant that serves like Thai food and like, and you're just like, what's happening? Yeah. Sushi and pad Thai. Right. Okay, go off. And one of them, Alan, he is beaten to almost death. And the father and the friends are like, it could have been any of us. Mm-hmm. And that's the point. It was supposed to be, it wasn't about Alan. It was about all of us. Like, it was targeted at all of us. And I
really felt that way. And this, I felt that way in 2020, 2021.
Yeah.
In the wake of the Atlanta shootings, for example. Yeah. But I should point out that this book was actually written before all of that.
Before
so it's
all
an
that.
Interesting and very prescient book, because I think it was written in 2019.
I think it came out in 2020.
It came out in 2020, but obviously written before. Yeah. So
yeah, and I think, like, you know, a thing that I learned in 2020 around like anti-Black racism, and not that I learned, but a thing that I think definitely didn't learn this then, but that that I think, you know, is a reminder is none of this is new.
Right.
And that's why a book like this could be written in 2019 and reference violence that was happening, I guess, like maybe in the 60s or 70s, I think. And that could feel just as prescient 4 years forward because none of this is new. And the anti-Asian violence and the anti-Asian, you know, rhetoric and hatred, that all it goes back, which is why he talks about, you know, the Chinese Exclusion Act and all of that. And he even talks about like the slurs that they're called and how like Chinaman is like, he's like, well that one feels sort of obvious,
accurate.
but also was like the worst one, right? Like that was when he was the most like uncomfortable with, even though he's like, I am from China and I am a man. So at least like that, like versus like when they call them like Jap or something, he's like, well, it's not really me.
Right.
So I did find all of that stuff with the dad's story probably to be like my favorite parts of the book, like the parts of the book that I was the most maybe touched by.
Yeah.
You know, I just found that to be really like, I'm really good. I don't know. It's not a great descriptor, but that's what I felt. It was good.
When they opened him up and we heard about the backstory of the dad, and this is actually one of my quibbles with the book. I loved the backstory and how much they developed the dad character.
Yeah.
And I worry that it was at the expense of the mom character. I would have liked to have a little bit more mom character. They talk about how she was always like the pretty Oriental girl or whatever they described her as, like the pretty Chinese lady. And that her looks mattered so much for so long until they didn't, until she became
invisible. But I think that was a choice, right? Like the choice is to follow the the male line.
Of course.
It's older brother. It's like, and I think that that also follows with the stereotypes around Asian women,
yeah.
which is like, they're just pretty and they just like,
I know.
Are nice and they make delicious food and they stand to the side and look beautiful right. and support their husband. So I think like it definitely was at the expense of the mom character, but I think that was on purpose.
Yeah, it's a defense. Yeah, it's totally a defensible choice in the service of the father-son story, the father and the two sons story, really.
Yeah.
And then also we did get a lot. We got a real glimpse into their marriage too, the mom and the dad's marriage, which I also enjoyed. So not only did I like the romantic montage between Willis and Karen, I also really liked the backstory. When the dad and the mom sort of met working at the restaurant and ended up having to get married there. And they
I loved the wedding.
Yeah, I did too.
It was very cute. I could just totally picture that scene, you know, in a movie.
Yeah, exactly. How did you read this book? How did you consume this book? Did you listen or did you read it?
I read it with my eyes off of the physical page.
Okay.
Yeah, just like a physical book.
I didn't love the audiobook experience that much, maybe just because of the narrator. I don't remember who it was. I don't think it's some notable narrator guy, but it's one of those things where some people who watched Past Lives, who speak Korean, were like, oh, I couldn't get past Greta Lee's Korean accent because it was so bad, you know, or I watched Awkwafina in The Farewell and her Chinese I couldn't get past. And in this case, the narrator just like messed up the romanization of a lot of the Chinese in there. And it just took me out of the story, I think. And also I expected black and white, the scenes where we got into the cop procedural, I expected more play with scoring. Like I wanted to hear the Law and Order, da-dum, you know?
Yeah.
I wanted to hear it acted out. So I felt as though as an audiobook experience, there was more opportunity to actually make it a play, like a scene.
Like an audio play.
But instead it was just this one guy.
Oh, interesting. That sort of sucks. I don't like that.
I know that you listen to a lot of audiobooks.
Yeah, I do. I don't usually listen to fiction because it's harder for me. For whatever reason, fiction's just hard, I think, because of the dialogue and everything. But I might go back and just listen to a little bit of this just
to see.
I know a lot of people in the Stacks Pack did listen.
I thought they did a disservice to the author by not having, not doing more with the audio experience.
Can I ask you something about Past Lives since you brought it up?
Yeah, sure.
Or just say something. I heard that criticism of Greta Lee's Korean, and obviously I don't speak Korean, so I really don't know. But wasn't that sort of her character because she had left Korea, so her accent would be bad? Or would they say, I guess she was old enough to probably still have a good accent by
the
time she left.
So I guess the argument among at least my Korean American friends is that she was supposed to have been born and raised in Korea until she was like 12 or 13.
Yeah, so she should have.
Right. She shouldn't have spoken like, you know, somebody who was born in the United States and just spoke occasionally with their parents or at church. But this is such a quibble. I mean,
I don't know. I can't speak to it, but I'm sure that if I was Korean or spoke Korean or whatever, I would be annoyed.
It took them out of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
For sure. However, as a non-Korean person, she was so good.
Oh, I felt that movie in my soul, man.
Her acting. She's a really great actress.
The line reads when they first connected on Skype.
Yes.
I felt it in every part of my body. I was just like, oh my God, beautifully done.
If you haven't seen the movie yet, people, it's on streaming now, so you can watch it. I think Paramount Plus has it.
Okay.
We'll link to it in the show notes.
Okay, fantastic.
I just watched it because the Oscars, you know, I've tried to catch everything right before the Oscars. Anyways. Wait, well, we should take a quick break and then we'll come right back. Okay, y'all. This past week, I threw a party in LA to celebrate the LA Times Book Festival and just generally bookish people all around. And it was the best time. I'm sure you've seen the pictures on Instagram, but I have to say a huge thank you to Lit Cocktails for helping make this party a total blast. Lit Cocktails is a mobile bartending company that provides a fun, personable, unique, yet professional experience for clients who want more than your average boring black tie bartenders. They're here for weddings, birthday parties, corporate events, or any other reason you might need to celebrate with a cocktail. Lit Cocktails is
owned and operated by Diamond Davis, a Black LGBTQ woman who started the company after losing her job as a restaurant manager during the 2020 pandemic. Diamond has created more than just a service. It is truly an experience, and it celebrates diversity, love, and community. I could feel that from the bar the entire evening. Diamond was a joy to have. She made the best drinks, always had a smile on her face, and honestly became one of my new favorite people. Lit cocktail packages include ice, garnishes, cups, napkins, straws, a customized menu, two specialty cocktails, non-alcoholic beverages and mixers, one free hour of setup and breakdown, and an alcohol shopping list. Literally, you don't need to do anything but hire Diamond. She takes care of the rest. They also offer tastings for an additional fee, where they customize 8 to 10 drinks based on your flavor profile, and they'll even bring them to your home for you to sample. Go book a free consultation today by visiting www.litcocktailsllc.com or send a DM to @litcocktails on Instagram. Again, that's litcocktailsllc.com or send a DM to @litcocktails on Instagram. When I started podcasting, an online store was truly the furthest thing from my mind. Now I'm selling super cute sweatshirts, tote bags, other bookish swag, and it's so easy. All because I use Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit $1 million order stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, they have you covered. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system for wherever or whatever you're selling. If you came to the Stax tour and bought merch, that was the in-person POS system. I'm just telling you, I use it. I love it. Turn your casual browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. It is 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. In case you don't know, I was an emotional mess when I first saw the Stax merchandise on a listener while out in public. After starting this podcast and building a community, I had to be talked into creating merchandise, and Shopify made it possible. There is a 0% chance I would have merch if Shopify wasn't so easy to use. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States? Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/thestax, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/thestax now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/thestax.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we're back. I want to talk more in depth about sort of the goal of assimilation or the idea of assimilation. Yeah. Because, you know, as I mentioned, I think the Black experience in America, Black American experience, not immigrant Black experience. So, you know, people whose families were here, brought here during, you know, from as early as the 1500s through to the end of slavery, like that experience. Assimilation is really different because, I guess not assimilation, but like the idea of like choosing to be here or like wanting to be American is different because
it wasn't a choice.
It wasn't a choice, yeah. But also like we built this country, you know? And so it is a different relationship. And I do think that Black Americans who, what I affectionately call slave Black, which I know a lot of people don't care for, but that's how I distinguish it from other Black Americans. Anyways, don't sue me.
So you mean, you distinguish it from like Caribbean Jamaican Americans.
Because the problem with blackness in America is like once you come to America, you immediately become African American or black, even if your family is Jamaican or what, you know, or if you are from Africa, like you're Nigerian, but you come here, your experience is totally different.
Right.
You know, first generation Nigerian American is a totally different experience than someone like me whose family has been here for I don't know how long, but at least since the 1860s, like, or whenever, 1830s. And so I think like we don't think of assimilation in the same way, even though there is a call to assimilate black people. There's always been a call to assimilate into American culture, but it's just different. Like there's no, this is the American dream. I'm coming to this place to, for a better life for my family. Right.
Yes. I totally get it.
And so I'm curious, like sort of your thoughts about assimilation and how you think about it, or how this book's talking about it resonated for you.
My thoughts on it have really evolved because as a child, assimilation was a real matter of survival. I just wanted to fit in. I didn't want to stand out.
Right.
I wanted to do whatever my white friends were doing and have the same food that my white friends were having and celebrate the same holidays and go to church despite the fact that my family wasn't religious. Like, I just wanted to fit in. As I've gotten older and really reckoned with my identity, I have come to think of assimilation as more a race that people of color can never win.
Right.
Right? It's set up in a way that we have to kind of aspire to something that we'll never achieve, which is being a white American.
Right.
And it forces this choice between success as it's defined in America and then our actual souls and our emotional engines and our cultures and who we are. And I often, especially growing up in the places I grew up, I often had to choose success or whatever was deemed successful. And I think that the effect that it had on me was kind of turning down some parts of me that I would have otherwise wanted to express. Like I would have wanted to try more sports, for example. But that was seen as something that Asian kids didn't do because Asian kids played musical instruments or excelled at school. Even at, like my big beef about a lot of Asian stereotypes is the math one in particular. Because I could never live up to the math one. But I have really come to reject assimilation because I see it as kind of rigged. And somebody who wrote an excellent book on this from the Latino perspective is Julissa Arce. She wrote a book called You Sound Like a White Girl. And it is an argument to kind of reject assimilation because of this notion of how it keeps people of color in a race that you can't win.
Yeah. Julissa came on the show. We talked about it and I loved our conversation. I feel like part of what's really interesting about like assimilation when it comes to, you know, immigrant groups is that there's like all these stereotypes that are also part of assimilation. Like, it's like what you're talking about of like having to be good at math because you're Asian, even though that is like the opposite of assimilation, because isn't it that like white people are just like regular at math, right? Like why should, like if you want to assimilate, you should just be like a B math student.
Right.
Like that would be really moving towards the white me.
But there's this model minority myth, right?
Right. That's held up. That you have to be like better, that you have to prove yourself and that then that's how you'll be accepted or whatever the logic is. But there's a part in the book where he says he asked to be treated like a white man. And I think more than anything, right, that is the goal of assimilation. It's like to be treated, like to have the powers and the abilities of white men.
Yes, you remind me of a really important exchange in the book, because I think one of the women, like maybe the white woman cop, even says to Willis, do you think you're the only one who's invisible? You're not the only one who's invisible. So, which is to say, white women can often be marginalized.
But let me just read it, because that's the exact sentence I'm talking about. So here's what Green says. She says, "What are you looking for? Do you think you're the only group to be invisible? How about older women, older people in general, people that are overweight, people that don't conform to conventional Western beauty standards, Black women, women in general in the workplace? Are you sure you're not looking for something that you feel entitled to? Isn't this a kind of narcissism? Mm. Are you sure you're not asking to be treated like a white man?"
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then brother in response says he's asking to be treated like an American, a real American. Because honestly, when you think American, what color do you see? White? Black?
Mm.
I mean, I would argue that when people say American, they don't see Black.
No.
Even though I would also argue that Black Americans are, you know, we've been here just as long.
Yeah. And the economy
did
of this,
a lot
and
more of the
economy
too.
Of this country.
Yeah. But I do think like, but I also find that argument from Green, like I just think about like white women feminism and like it's a thing that I feel like I have experienced, and I'm curious if you've experienced it too, where you express a feeling or a feeling of like frustration or wanting to be treated in a certain way, and then immediately a white woman comes in and says, "Well, what do you think?
I am women also go oppressed."
Yes, women, older women, ugly women, women who don't conform to beauty standard. Like, okay, Green, we're not fucking talking about you right now. Can you just go be white in the corner for a second quietly while we talk about whether or not I have kidnapped myself? Like I just find that, of course, to be so spot on. And she's not wrong, but also, like, this
who's
is
on
not,
trial right now, right?
Yeah, this is not your moment. Yeah,
your house isn't on fire right now. So,
right.
So we don't have to put out those particular flames. So,
right. And also all of those groups of people that you've named, if they were Asian on top of it, it would be worse for them.
Hugely important point, right?
Yeah. And I just like, I don't know. I just wonder, like, I think I know the answer, but I just really wonder, like, when we talk about assimilation, is being a white guy really aspirational when we think of all that white men have done and like what that moral ethos is, or if you can even like even have one?
Right. This is why the logic of assimilation doesn't really make that much sense when you think about it too hard, because you're not really wanting to be a mediocre white guy. You want the privileges afforded to a mediocre white guy, the way that they get the benefit of the doubt, the confidence that they have when they walk into a room despite being wholly unqualified. Mm-hmm. That kind of benefit of the doubt is what I think seems so aspirational to Willis in this book and to other marginalized groups often. But actually being the guy is a different thing.
I think that what people who want to assimilate, what they're asking for, what they want is to be seen and heard as they are. Yeah. They don't actually necessarily want to be white. If they could do it without conforming to whiteness, I think that they would not. Generally, I don't know. I can't speak to everybody.
Sure,
I do think that there are some people of color from all different groups who would like to be white. But
what are you really wanting is what we're trying to get at, right?
Is that important? Like, if you could, you know, I think like one of the things you hear a lot from kids, like especially Asian kids, is lunchtime. They bring food and then other kids say racist shit to them. But if those kids could just fucking eat their food in peace and still and not get made fun of, whatever, would they want to eat different food? Do you know what I mean? That's like a really plain, boring example, like not a great analogy. But I think like the question of assimilation is, if I could just live my life as I am and not get beat up for it and not get like racist things said and not get paid a fraction of what other people get paid for it, would I actually want to be a white guy?
No. And I think that the reason why then is just the privileges that it affords you, the privileges to exist how you are and eat what you want and play the instruments that you want or the sports or try the things. So the general sense of selfhood and just existing how you are.
Right. But of course, that's impossible here because of the way the racism functions in all of our systems. Did you read Minor Feelings by Kathy Parcom?
Yes. It was an essay collection. I reviewed it, I think.
Did you? Mm-hmm. Okay. I read it and I liked it. I didn't love it in the way that a lot of people loved it. I think like the first few essays are really good and interesting. And I think like it sort of like lost me in the back half.
There were some that were highly academic.
Yeah.
That I also got lost in, but there were some essays that spoke to me and also educated me a lot that I didn't sort of know. So I thought overall it was a good book. I gave it a pretty good review, except for the parts where I was like, okay, this is this is getting too cerebral.
Yeah, I agree. But I think, like, you know, what the book has been sort of turned, what people think of the book now is like, it's a conversation about being Asian in America, in a black and white America kind of thing, right? Like, that there's not a space that exists in America for Asian people because America is so black and white. And I think that that's like obviously what he's getting with calling the TV show Black and White. And I find
he was that
argument,
on the nose on purpose. Yeah,
it's so on the nose. I literally took a note. I was like, America equals black and white. And then they were like, cut. Okay. But I think like that conversation is also really interesting to me because there's another book that came out last year called Biting the Hand by Julia Lee. It's a memoir and essays. It's so good. It's really, really, I highly, highly recommend it. And I think like it's a perfect pairing for this book because she's talking about being Asian in a black and white America. She's raised in LA and she's sort of old enough to be coming of age a bit during the LA riots, which she talks about. She has one of the best essays in the book is about the riots. But I find that like it's a tricky balance to think about Asianness and blackness because so much of like the Asian American like rights movement was modeled off of a lot of like the work that black people did. But there is this tension between the two groups. And like this book sort of gets at it a little bit. And I don't know, I was thinking a lot about that stuff. Because I know that there is anti-Asian black people have anti-Asian racism and Asian people have anti-black racism. And like, but also the groups have worked in solidarity together, you know. And so I don't know, just that was a thing that I was thinking about a lot.
I think that the myth of the model minority is also about proximity to whiteness. And that keeps or has stopped a lot of people in my community for showing up in solidarity with black Americans, with Arab Americans and other communities, because it's this idea of like, oh, if we can just be accepted, if we can be part of the in-group, then forget about everybody in the out-group. Like, we'll just try and maintain our own safety within this cocoon of accepted culture, which tends to be white culture, you know? And I think about that with respect to O.J. Simpson a lot. Mm. You brought up the L.A. riots, which made me think of O.J. Simpson. One of the most powerful pieces of culture I've seen in the last 10 years was the O.J. Simpson 30 for 30, Made in America.
The Made in America.
Yeah, the Made in America, the Ezra Edelman documentary.
So fucking
about
good.
O.J.
I was just
because,
looking at it yesterday.
Yeah, because O.J. is about everything. It ends up being about celebrity culture, freeways, McDonald's, guest houses, crime, but most prominently race and identity. And then there are were instances, especially in LA, of Asian versus black violence that had happened. And Made in America covers this. But OJ specifically, for a long time, was denying his blackness, especially within the Tony community of Brentwood in Los Angeles. He would say, I'm not black. I'm OJ.
Right.
Believing that he had somehow transcended race. And I think that's the way that the model minority works, too. This notion that, oh, if you can be good enough, you can strive hard enough and you can be accepted by white culture and whatever Tony community you're living in, then don't worry about everybody else.
Right. Well, and I also think what's interesting about like the proximity to whiteness is that that model minority Asian myth only pertains to certain Asian groups also.
Exactly.
You know, like it is aside from... Well, no, I mean, it's mostly East Asian and then Indian and I guess Pakistani to some extent.
Right.
But like other Asian groups, like
Southeast
folks from
Asians.
Myanmar or like, yeah, like
Islanders.
Thailand. Yeah. It doesn't pertain to them. And I think like, yes, you're getting at the right thing with like someone like OJ. There's also like a really large group of mixed black and white people who have famously said similar types of things. The current head coach of the Miami Dolphins, who is one of my personal nemesis because of what he said, he's mixed. He looks white. People don't know that he's mixed. His dad is black. And people were like, oh, you're black. And sorry, the history of this is that he took the job of this black coach who was fired, who then sued the NFL for racism. They hired this mixed kid and people were asking him about it. And they were like, he was like, why do you keep asking me about this? Yes, my dad is black and I'm a human being.
Oh, right. The I'm a human being.
I'm a human being. And then there's another famous black woman, mixed woman tennis player. Her name is Madison Keys.
Right.
She said, I'm just Madison. I'm not mixed. I'm Madison.
What a privilege. What a privilege to be able to say that.
And also, like, no, Madison, you're black. I can look at you and see it, lady. Like, congratulations. But I do find, like, this wanting to be close to whiteness is so interesting. And also part of that model minority myth, whiteness needs that. Because just like how the wealthy, this is, you know, this is a quick history lesson for those of you at home, just like how the wealthy, white, slave-owning class in the South needed poor whites to be white because otherwise they were outnumbered, and they knew if the poor whites and the blacks got together, the whole slavery thing was going to be over. Mm. They granted them privileges of whiteness.
Yes.
And that's sort of what's happened with like that mono-minority class of Asians, is that they've allowed, whiteness has allowed them in just enough to keep them loyal, but not enough to like grant them any real, you know, humanity in any way. And so, I mean, but I think this book is like so good because like you said, it's funny and all of that, but it brings up all of this stuff. It brought up all of this stuff for me at least.
Yes.
And clearly it brought up a lot for
me
you.
Too.
And I think for a lot of readers, there's a big, we're sort of running out of time.
Yeah.
There's a big final speech that Willis gives. It's on page 244 in my book.
Okay, so we have solved, so by the time we are at this part in this podcast episode, we have solved the mystery of the trial, right?
Yes, I think so. I feel like we have, but someone's going to tell me we got it wrong, and that's fine. Just tell me, just DM me, let me know how bad I did.
I think what you clarified about what happens at the end of Act 5 illuminated that for me. Okay, so I get it now.
We get it now. And so then in the courtroom, he like gets to give this big speech, and he talks about like how he finally got his shot and he wanted to be a kung fu guy. And then I wondered like why I even wanted it so bad. And Turner jumps in and he's like, it's because they used you guys against us and against yourselves. And you know, the big line of the book is kung fu guy is just another form of generic Asian man.
Mm.
That like even the pinnacle of Asianness is just a different version of stereotypical Asian.
Right.
You could be
You're still
kung fu
a stereotype.
Yeah, it's still a stereotype. And then he says, you know, we're all the same, aren't we? Generic Asian man. Maybe I'm kung fu guy at the moment, but I know as well as you all do that this is about half a rung above jack shit.
Mm.
It sucks being generic Asian man. Internalizing the role so completely that I've lost track of where reality starts and the performance begins. So anyways, there's this, just this huge speech that just feels like Charles Yu is like, hello, here I am. Let me just write my thoughts. And this is really it for me. And I do feel like this speech, while it's really good and interesting for me as a reader, was a little too on the nose and a little too preachy. Like I felt like Charles Yu, in doing this speech, lost a lot of what was so great about the book, was that he was doing a lot of this work without actually having to say
it. Yeah, he was doing it with the form. Speech, we sort of got it from the way he structured this book all along.
Right. But he does eventually give in to the...
the Shonda Rhimes speech.
Yeah. However, or the Barbie speech,
right,
the America First speech. However, I would like to probably just blame his editor for this. I love to blame an editor for something that someone does that I don't like. So I'm going to blame his editor.
Yeah, let's do that.
I don't know who his editor is, but you failed us all. I mean, you failed us with this National Book Award winning book.
Yeah.
What a failure this book has been. Damn it. In each of the sections that start, there's these quotes, and they come from Irving Goffman, Bonnie Sue, and Philip Choi. And I looked up those people because I was like, who are these people? So Goffman is a social psychologist, a very famous American white guy. And then Sue is the author of a book called American Chinatown, and Choi is an architect who wrote San Francisco Chinatown. So those three people are sort of talking about the psychology behind the physicalness
the place.
Like, of the place and sort of the idea of the two places. And of course, the quote that starts the book that I was like, oh, I love this book already, is, if a film needed an exotic backdrop, Chinatown could be made to represent itself or any other Chinatown in the world. Even today, it stands in for the ambiguous Asian anywhere. Mm.
Yeah, that was a really powerful way to start the book. And I liked all the section heads, actually. I'm glad that you looked up who...
Yeah, I was just curious. I was like, who? Because usually, like, sometimes in books, the section heads like a different person each time. So it's just like the quote, but it kept being the same people. So I was like, who are these people?
Oh, who they're people who write about Chinatown as a place. Yeah, we didn't get to talk too much about Chinatown specifically, and then the kind of gangsters and things, like the activity that happens in Chinatown, the gambling or the fronts for other businesses or like more nefarious businesses, and then like the counterfeit bags. And other tropes of Chinatown that we didn't
all
get to
the like that was, it's like restaurants and then like seedy behavior,
right? the way that they set that up, the way that Charles
and oh, it. And like tenement housing, of course,
exactly. Yes, the housing
like
was rough,
shitty housing, food, and then bad like shady dealings,
gambling, and counterfeit bags.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. Like illegal activity.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Which is just so interesting that like the place of Chinatown. Is that's the stereotype when the stereotype, I guess the stereotype of the people, but like you would think if the stereotype really tracked with other stereotypes, there would also be like a math academy or like, you know what I mean? Like there would be other like racist ideas about like the physical space.
Yeah.
Well, we should talk about the title and the cover, which we always talk about.
Yeah.
You and I both have the paperback cover that has the sort of like, temple.
Yeah, it's a pagoda, looking, right? With the
pagoda.
With the roof, the classic roof and the framing, the door, or I guess this looks like kind of the wood paneling.
Yeah, and then there's like, you know, clouds and it's red and green and yellow and pink a little. I love this cover. I actually like this cover better than the hard cover, which I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I haven't seen it. Maybe we can pull it up. Oh, okay. The original one looked more like it also has a kind of pagoda roof.
Yeah. It has a pagoda, but the original one has like some Chinese characters. And it has like a camera and then like a kung fu foot. And I don't dislike this cover, but I think the paperback cover, it has the courier on the cover as well. So you kind of like get a sense of what's to be inside.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know that either of them exactly tell me what I'm going to get, but I more just visually prefer the paperback cover to me. I think maybe the colors are working better for me.
There's certainly more color in the paperback cover.
Yeah. The hardcover colors is yellow, white, and red, which is of course like the Chinese.
Yeah, it looks like an old poster.
You know what it sort of looks like? The little bag for like Lunar New Year that they put. That
the red envelope. Or a Chinese takeout container.
Yeah,
with the red and the white, the stark red
and white. So I like both, but I think I slightly prefer the paperback.
I can also take paperback books around so much more easily, so I prefer.
I prefer paperback for logistic reasons. What did you think of the title?
I thought it was clever. Because we talked about how in screenplays you have to write the shot. And the first thing in the law is the first thing when you write the shot is the log line, which is exterior or interior. Mm-hmm. It's also how you describe character when you're writing a screenplay, because you have to work out the character's interior motivations and exterior motivations.
Right.
So the title is working on all these different levels. It also takes place literally in interior Chinatown, so much of this story. So I like a euphemism.
Yeah, I think it was good. It also comes up in the book in two spots, sort of. In page 89, it's not exactly the title, but it's close enough for me to have noted it. At least I saw it like in the text as opposed to like a stage direction. He says he is tired. He spent decades in this place, in the interior of Chinatown. But then on 219... older brother's talking, said, I never left, not really, not in the way that counts inside. In my mind, another part of me is in a different place now. Interior Chinatown isn't the whole world anymore. I had to leave in my own way, just like you tried to do. So it is like also in the text, which I always love when it pops up in the text.
If he writes a sequel, I hope that he writes a sequel from the perspective of older brother. Just because, you know, there's a lot of talk about oldest child energy and everything these days, and oldest child energy as it intersects with striving immigrant energy must be so fascinating to get into.
Well, and also because I would love that too, because Willis is striving towards the American dream, but as far as Willis is concerned, older brother has achieved it. So I wonder how older brother would feel about whiteness and assimilation if he is the one who has, quote unquote, done what needed to be done.
Yeah, and that page 219 speaks to it a little bit about how he never really got to leave.
Okay, last thing we're going to do is, if they turn it into a movie, who would you cast?
Oh gosh, there's so many great Chinese American, Taiwanese American actors out these days. This is always so hard because casting. Once I say someone, it'll be kind of the wrong person.
Oh, it's okay. I say the wrong person all the time, and then people just DM me and they're like, I can't believe you didn't say da da da. But what I can tell you guys today is I actually have cast the perfect
Willis
black and white.
Oh
no, I don't know. Oh, Willis. Yeah. My black and white, my white, my green, Jennifer Lawrence.
Oh, yes.
I know. And my black, Jay Ellis.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's
Goodbye.
So good.
It's perfect. I don't want to hear it from anybody.
Okay.
I don't want to hear a word from any of you people that I didn't get that one right, because it is the way that they describe her is like, she would just go drink a beer with someone. She's so beautiful, but also like so down to earth and a little bright. I was like, Jennifer Lawrence, bye.
So, you know,
cast Charles Melton as older brother.
Would you? Yeah. Cause he's so high achieving and he's so hot
and he's big and like,
I could totally see a Charles Melton. I wonder if there would be blowback because he's half.
Yeah. I'd say he's half.
Right. But you know who I like for Karen is there was a Disney star like on Disney, some sort of Disney Channel show named Diane Doan. She would be really great for Karen, or Leah Lewis, who is known for that Netflix show. Leah Lewis did the half of it on Netflix.
Okay.
I could totally see her as a Karen. I guess I'm sort of casting young. And that's why I'm having a lot of trouble with Willis Wu, just because I imagine somebody who's younger because he's coming of age, but... or coming up in the acting ranks.
Right. Yeah. It's hard because eventually he does get older, but
How do you get somebody who transcends? There's not enough Asian leading men. Asian leading men. I really like the Australian who was Henry Golding's buddy who took him out on that bachelorette party who took him out on the boat
in the Crazy Rich Asians.
Right.
Yeah.
God, oh my God.
I really like Harry Golding. So
you could always
Henry Golding.
You could always put Simu Liu in.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
Now I feel like maybe he's too big of a movie star.
No, we need a big
movie
star.
You want kind of an
up
and coming guy,
I guess,
right?
You're right? Yeah. Yeah. That's true. I mean, it's a hard one to cast because like you need to be able to do age and to be like sort of unknown enough to like do it. But I don't know.
Why? I'm going to land on Simu Liu for now. And please come at me, listeners. I'm going to land on Simu Liu for now because, A, his physicality. So I think he could do the big kung fu set pieces really well because there's a giant kung fu set piece in this.
Right.
And then, B, he used to be a star of stock photos. I don't know if you know about this. He was a big guy in iStock photos.
What?
Yes. And he sort of celebrates his previous roles as generic Asian man in iStock photos. And so I feel as though he could call back and call upon those days for this particular character.
I like this casting. Simu Liu, I'm still not convinced on Karen yet. Maybe one of those young girls. But if we cast him, that's too young.
Right.
I think.
then that's
and
awkward.
Then Jennifer Lawrence and
Jay Ellis. So attractive.
At first I was gonna do Michael B. Jordan, but then I read the text again and I was like, no.
Jay Ellis is a perfect detective.
The perfect detective. Because he's like a little goofy too, right? And then he like does like the smoldering look and
he's super tall, I think.
He is. I've met him.
Oh, you have? Yeah. He seems super tall from television.
He was very nice. Oh, unfortunately for me, I was like, oh, you're a lovely person.
I'm melting.
Yeah, I was. It was a lot for me emotionally. I'm still not over it. This was like a year ago. Okay. I think we did it all. We didn't really talk about the daughter, the like next Phoebe. Generation. I don't know. Anything you want to say about her?
Yeah. She was a precocious young Asian American girl. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts? I didn't really have any big insights about her.
I think that like I was the least interested in that part of the book. And so I think I didn't really think about it that much.
He's obviously
saying something about like this next generation that like doesn't, you know, she lives out in the suburbs. She's out like outside of the interior of Chinatown and gets to have this like perfect life and is emotionally available and understands and, you know, all of those things.
She was serving a narrative purpose and less of a character that stood on her own. So I really don't have any fully formed thoughts about her, to be honest.
Me neither. Okay. Me neither. Okay. Well, sorry to you, Phoebe. We don't really care about you, but better luck next time. Maybe
I
in your
kids,
uncle's
though.
Sequel.
I still love kids.
Yeah, we love. I don't. But you do. You've got three. You do love kids. Well, everyone, I think we did it. Aside from Phoebe, we're done here. Listen to the end of today's episode to find out what our book club pick will be for April. And make sure you go get Flawless, which is Elise's book. And Elise, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It was so much fun. And sorry, Phoebe.
Sorry, Phoebe. Everyone else besides Phoebe, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening, and thank you again to Elise Hugh for joining the show. I'd also like to say a huge thank you to Alana Nevins for helping to make this conversation possible. All right, drum roll, please. It is time to announce our April Book Club pick. As you all know, April is National Poetry Month, so here at The Stacks, we always talk about a poetry collection in April, and this month we're discussing The January Children by Safia El Hilo. The book is a collection of poetry about home, displacement, family, and coming into one's own. We will discuss the book on Wednesday, April 24th, and you need to listen on Wednesday, April 3rd to find out who our guest will be for that conversation. If you love this show and you want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And you can check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.